Okay, welcome to our scramble. I should say that I was off for a few days. I had this idea that I was going to just putter around and get away from things. And what I learned was, if you're going to do that, you have to be like Jason Bourne. You have to like take your SIM card out and smash it in half with a hammer. And they've been sort of up-classifying those things with each, you know, progressive movie. And now you have to smash the SIM card in half with a hammer, put one of the halves down a storm drain, and give the other half to like a pelican or something. And then you have to do the same thing with your laptop and everything, or at minimum air gap everything. You have to go Ed Snowden. Anyway, I didn't do that, and I paid a price. I have one other thing that I have to tell you before we get going today, and that is about a week ago, Kyone Wolf, whom you often hear kicking off this show, was involved in a car versus bike crash. She was on the bike part of that. She's going to be fine. We're going to get her back, but it's she did sustain significant injuries. It's going to be a little bit of a recuperation process. So we first of all want you to know that she's thinking of you, and we probably want her to know that you're thinking of her. She would like you to know. I've been in constant contact with her during this time, that if you are out on your bike, please do wear your helmet. If she had not been wearing a helmet, I would be making a much more somber announcement to you right now. And then if you're the person driving the car, just, you know, follow the rules of the road and understand that bicycles also have to follow the rules of the road and treat bicycles like another motor vehicle. Those are her two messages for you out there. But anyway, I'm laughing, but this was a little bit scary. She's going to be fine. We're going to get her back. Might be 2 weeks, might be more. You may hear us struggling a little bit one way or another to kind of make up the difference between having her and not having her. It's a big difference. She does a lot of great things for us. So anyway, when you hear that, that's what you're hearing. All right, we're going to move on here. We're going to talk today. We now know on Mondays that we're going to talk about the presidential campaign. We don't always know which thing we're going to talk about because it moves and it changes so fast. So that certainly is the case today. We're going to spend the first couple of segments talking with Alex Eisenstadt, who writes about politics for Politico. And then in the final segment, not because of what happened to Kyone, but just because it's a matter of some interest, we are going to talk about driverless cars. There was not a driverless car involved in what I just told you about, but we're going to talk about driverless cars. There was a horrible accident. It was actually in May, but we just found out about it, involving a driverless car. We'll tell you a little bit more about the state of the technology, law, and psychology of all that with Willow Ramis, senior technology writer at Slate.com and a regular guest on this show. But we're going to get started now with Alex Eisenstadt. First of all, welcome to our airwaves.
Thanks for having me.
And, you know, I think we knew kind of what we were going to be talking about today as we made these arrangements, but then maybe we didn't know exactly what we were going to be talking about. So I think we have to sort of have to start at the top here. Obviously, about 90 minutes ago, FBI Director James Comey came out, addressed the press, the world, and said that for the first 15 minutes kind of described an environment of extreme carelessness involving the private email server of Hillary Clinton while she was Secretary of State, said that it was basically worse than what we've been told so far, and there may be damage done. It's not possible to know how compromised some of this classified and or top secret information was, and then spent like the last 3 minutes saying, but on the other hand, there's probably not too much we can do about it.
Yeah, look, I mean, this was, people were sort of expecting a slap on the wrist. This was more than a slap on the wrist. I mean, this was a pretty sharp rebuke from the FBI, saying that Secretary Clinton was exceedingly careless when it came to handling classified information, that at some point in time that the information she was transmitting via email may have been susceptible to access from bad actors. But then the director of the FBI goes on to say that, look, we're not going to have any we're not going to recommend any charges against her. And so, look, I mean, on one level, you could say the Clinton campaign is obviously happy that this is behind them. On the other hand, is it really behind them? Because now what you have is you have fodder for attacks from Republicans who are going to say that this is evidence that she was exceedingly careless. And it's also sort of in Donald Trump's wheelhouse. He's now going to be saying that, look, this is an example of how the system is rigged, that despite all this evidence that the FBI has gathered that Secretary Clinton acted in a way that she should not have, she's not facing any charges. And that's more evidence that somehow the system is stacked in favor of her, in favor of the administration and people in power. And that's the charge that Donald Trump has been making against Hillary Clinton. It's become a sort of a central plank of his campaign.
Right. So actually, there were sort of in some ways three distinct messages from James Comey today. Two of them are the ones that we've said, that A, this was reckless, it was careless, it was irresponsible. There may have been some damage from it in ways that we will not be able to account for very easily. That's sort of number one. Number two, based on everything we know about how you prosecute cases, that this doesn't really rise to that level. They looked at case law, they looked at precedent, they just didn't see any real basis they said, no reasonable prosecutor would bring this case. And then the third thing that he said, because of all the things that you just said, Alex, is this was a responsible investigation. It was an untainted investigation. I didn't tell anybody in any other government agency what I was going to say before I walked out here to say it, and nobody monkeyed around with us. I mean, that was a big part of his message, that don't go looking at me as somebody who's now compromised because this is where I came out.
Yeah, look, he knew he saw what was coming. He knew Republicans were going to question his decision and wanted to get out ahead of that. And look, I mean, this is something that is going to be talked about for some time. But at the same time, it's going to be hard to argue that he somehow acted unfairly in this, given the strength of his statement, given what he's accusing Clinton of doing.
Right. Let's hear a little bit of James Comey making that point about his office's integrity.
Although the Department of Justice makes final decisions on matters like this, we are expressing to Justice our view that no charges are appropriate in this case. I know there will be intense public debate in the wake of this recommendation, as there was throughout the investigation. What I can assure the American people is that this investigation was done honestly, competently, and independently. No outside influence of any kind was brought to bear. I know there were many opinions expressed by people who are not part of the investigation, including people in government, but none of that mattered to us. Opinions are irrelevant, and they were all uninformed by insight into our investigation because we did our investigation the right way.
So shut up. And you can hear him kind of thumping, too. He's hitting something as he's saying this. And I think one thing we have to say about this, Alex, is that, this campaign has been remarkable in so many different ways. Mm-hmm. And one of the ways it's remarkable is that one thing tends to drive out another very, very quickly. So we were maybe going to be talking about, and maybe we still will for like 90 seconds, about the so-called Star of David Trump tweet that had created quite a bit of controversy over the weekend, except that this thing comes. And you kind of know that this thing will sit out here for a day or two, and then something else will happen, particularly because Donald Trump, whether he realizes it or not, tends to create an awful lot of news, and maybe even news that drives out news that he could really kind of exploit and benefit from. And so the way that you deal with that phenomenon ordinarily is to make an ad or make a bunch of campaign ads that do kind of a supercut of James Comey saying the most damning things he can possibly say. But so far, Trump has sort of been like this human sandwich board for himself, and he's really shown a lot of inclination to present his ideas in this other way.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. I mean, you're making a great point about this campaign generally, which is that it's hard for any story to gain traction for more than 48 hours. Now, the interesting thing about over the weekend is that the story that really dominated was, as you mentioned, the Star of David tweet, which really sucked up the political news cycle for the entirety of the holiday weekend. And now that's not really be talked about as much because it has been supplanted by another event. And you are going to see – look, I mean, you're going to see other storylines get traction this week. I mean, Donald Trump is supposedly going to announce his list of speakers at the Republican convention tomorrow. That is something that's going to get a lot of attention. And then we're going to move on to the Veep stakes, right? I mean, it's expected that Trump is going to announce his Veep selection next week. And then we're on to the convention. So I think you're hitting on a critical point about how in this information age, in this campaign that's largely driven by Twitter, that's driven by social media, news stories have very short attention, short shelf lives.
Right. So, I mean, at the convention, once again, I'm sure that they will evoke Comey. Once they may have edited sure. highlight reels or lowlight reels of Comey. As they go through this, they're going to try to preserve this. But it does, in fact, we are alluding to this Star of David tweet for the 10 or 11 people left who didn't learn about that over the weekend because they wisely air-gapped their computers. We should explain this. This is a tweet that Donald Trump sent out attacking Hillary Clinton, but it wasn't original with him. He kind of sampled it, I guess, from elsewhere. And so, Alex, just tell us a little bit more about this. This sort of came, the tweet, the image that he had, which involved sort of some words inside a red star that was shaped like the Star of David. It did come from some kind of alt-right bulletin board and also had been tweeted by somebody who one might assume would have some anti-Semitic purpose in using the Star of David.
Right. So this is a tweet that popped, I believe it was a Saturday morning, the Trump campaign tweeted it out. It basically called it had a star that was actually the shape of a Star of David, that it was on top of a bed of money next to an image of Hillary Clinton. It called Clinton, quote-unquote, the most corrupt candidate ever. And so it was immediately revealed that this is taken from a, as you mentioned, taken from a site that also propagates anti-Semitic messages. Now, the Trump campaign towards the end of the week was silent about this over the course of the weekend. Finally, last night, came out and said that it was lifted from a Twitter user that creates a lot of anti-Clinton messaging and images. Look, I mean, the bottom line is that there was a lot of back and forth over this. The Trump campaign insisting this was not a Star of David, that it was just a regular star. A lot of folks pushing back saying, in fact, this is a Star of David. And so the whole incident really demonstrated the Trump campaign's ongoing struggle to message issues and to gain controversy at a time when the entirety of the political conversation should be about Hillary Clinton and the issues surrounding her email server. Instead, we spent most of the weekend talking about is Donald Trump propagating anti-Semitic views?
Right. And the whole thing became, if it weren't so serious, it would be silly. You heard the expression squaring a circle. They circled the star. They took the star. They turned it into a red circle. Might be sort of like coloring in the space right. between the points. They didn't even, all this kind of idiocy went on. But, at the heart of it, the problem that lived at the heart of it was the question of what is Donald Trump's relationship with these far-right groups that are either white supremacists or anti-Semites or some combination. This just isn't the first time it came up. He had a lot of trouble publicly repudiating David Duke, and there just seems to be some kind of conduit. Whether he's fully conscious of the meaning of that conduit or not, there seems to be some conduit where information from this part of the political spectrum, the part of the political spectrum you usually address yeah. with a clothespin on your nose, it seeps into his campaign with some regularity. And I think it does make fair game, to ask, well, how does that keep happening? We would understand once or twice, but it seems to be with some regularity. You're getting stuff from these groups and kind of pushing it up there more or less as your own.
Right. And look, I mean, this is a conversation that we seem to have had now several times. David Duke, that came up earlier in this campaign. There's no question that Trump is attracting, supporters who seem to be on sort of sometimes the fringes of what's known as sort of the alt-right community, and he seems to be stimulating support in a way that Republican candidates like Mitt Romney and John McCain really simply didn't really didn't seek out and seem to do. But it also shows that, you know, look, I mean, here's a campaign that has kind of struggled to professionalize itself, right? You know, we keep on hearing that the Trump campaign is going to be turning into what looks to be more like a more professionalized traditional campaign, and yet every time we hear that, something like this happens. And it's one of the things that has sort of stimulated doubts among many in the Republican Party about whether Donald Trump has the infrastructure, has the campaign that one needs in order to win.
So let's swing back to Hillary Clinton and the problems that this presents for her. Then we'll take a break, and we also want to talk to Alex a little bit about the coming Republican convention and specifically about a movement that he has written about within the Republican Party to essentially restructure it. We'll come to that in a second. But so for Hillary Clinton, there's been a significant, I mean, one of the criticisms generally directed at her is this vague sense that she's untrustworthy and that she, you know, I mean, William Safire ages ago called her a congenital liar. That kind of idea has stuck. And it seems to me that one of the problems she may have coming out of today is not so much all the other stuff that Comey said about carelessness, but that when people have a moment to think about it, the fact pattern that Comey laid out is different from the fact pattern that she laid out. One of the things that she's consistently said was that there wasn't really classified material contained in these emails. I'm sure people are now mapping Comey's comments versus what she said on the record about this, and to whatever degree it doesn't square, that could, at a much more granular level, get to be a problem for her.
You know, it could, and it's something that you can expect to show up in Republican ads this fall. I mean, you know, you could have side by sides of what Hillary Clinton said versus what James Comey said. And to your point, Hillary Clinton's biggest weakness in this election is that voters don't find her to be trustworthy, and it's a problem for her. And this is something that is simply going to exacerbate that problem.
Right. And we also know that Huma Abedin, her key aide, had sort of said something different in her conversations with the FBI, that she was worried about this as early as 2010, which, again, this is the person who sticks to her like glue, who is as close to us as anybody gets, and is telling a slightly different story. Like, no, I wasn't sanguine about this. I was worried about this. So, you know, to whatever degree she can't, the Clinton can't even control the messages coming out of her own side, she's getting into almost the same kind of problem that Trump is having, a kind of mixed message about certain aspects of the campaign.
Yeah, and look, you know, here's the thing, which is that this is an attack that you're going to hear at the Republican convention on Hillary Clinton again and again and again. You're going to have 4 days of consecutive attacks on Hillary Clinton that are going to go that are going to center around whether or not she is trustworthy, and you're going to have Republicans if this convention is conducted in a way that's effective, that is going to try to chip away at her trustworthiness, that's going to try to highlight questions about whether people can trust her.
We're going to take a little break here. We're going to come back more of Alex Eisenstadt from Politico. He's been reporting on kind of a splinter faction or a splinter movement within the Republican Party nationally.
President. Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton.
All right, we're back with Alex Eisenstadt, who covers the presidential campaign right now for Politico. So, Alex, you wrote last week about a number of things leading into the Republican convention. It's coming up in a few weeks. One of them is something that hasn't been written about much anywhere else. A guy named Ken Cuccinelli, who's got a proposal that would essentially reconfigure the national committee. Explain, first of all, tell us who Ken Cuccinelli is and then what he wants to do.
Sure. So, you know, next week, starting next week, the week before the Republican National Convention, you're going to have a series of party meetings in which they're going to map out the rules that are going to govern the party in the years to come. And, you know, you are going to have a situation where not only is the party going to decide the rules governing this convention and who ultimately will end up being nominated, which is almost certainly going to end up being Donald Trump, despite efforts to stop him. But you're going to have certain things that are going to be discussed about the future of the party, how party primaries are going to be held, how the party, how the RNC and the party generally is going to function. And so into this, you are going to have a debate about, you know, about how the party should work. And there's a lot of disagreement in the party, especially at a time when many people in the GOP are unhappy about Donald Trump's rise and believe that more should have been done to stop him, and a desire to figure out how can we stop Donald Trump's in the future from winning the nomination. So you take a guy by the name of Ken Cuccinelli. He's the former Attorney General of Virginia. He ran unsuccessfully for governor for governor in Virginia in 2013. He was a major supporter of Ted Cruz, and he's interested in influencing the rules of this convention. He's a veteran of party conventions in the past. He understands the ins and outs of conventions. And what he wants to do is he is proposing something that is really bold, which is to strip away the power of future Republican National Committee chairman. He believes that the power of the party should be decentralized away from the RNC and away from an all-powerful chairman. And what he wants to do is he wants to bring power to what he describes as the grassroots of the party. It's something that he has been talking about, proposing. He has not finalized any proposal, but it is something that he is talking about in the run-up to these Rules Committee meetings, which begin next week.
So, I mean, it's curious, too, because, I mean, some would look at the current situation. I mean, there certainly is a lot of dissatisfaction with Donald Trump as the nominee, a lot of how did we come to this, how could this happen? You've got the two living Republican ex-presidents are not going to be attending the convention. So are a lot of other important Republicans not attending the convention. So, yeah, it's natural to say, well, how did we get here and how could we change this so that this never happened again? But, you know, it seems, looking at it, as though the cure he's proposing is kind of the opposite of what the disease might call for. In other words, one of the ways that you got there was because there weren't enough powerful people who could stop it. I've talked to Republican political consultants, or I've sort of heard them talking, saying, boy, we should have superdelegates like the Democrats have. If we had more superdelegates, we might have been able to stop this. But it's hard to look at this situation and go, well, you need the power flowing down lower into the grassroots. To me, that looks like how they got into this mess in the first place.
Yeah, look, I mean, here's the problem, which is that there is simply there's so much debate within the party about how should the party function. It's, you don't have these debates going on within the Democratic Party. It's much more united. Whereas the Republican Party, you have a lot of disagreement about how should things work moving forward, who should have power, and ultimately there are no easy solutions to these kinds of questions. Now here's the thing, which is that Ken Cuccinelli's proposal, should it end up going through, should end up hitting the floor of the Rules Committee, it's not likely to pass. It is exceedingly unlikely. Most people think that diminishing the power of the RNC chairman would only create more upheaval and more chaos in a party that's already racked by it.
So, and I mean, this proposal also is viewed by some more moderate Republicans as kind of a Trojan horse. That
right.
really what this is a bunch of strong conservatives. Cuccinelli comes out of the Cruz campaign. Morton Blackwell, who's the guy that you cite,
right,
who's sort of a longtime Republican operative, goes back to the 1980s, is the kind of guy who thinks the Republicans would do better if they were more conservative. And
right,
I think moderates are looking at the thing that you wrote about, saying, you know, this isn't about fixing the thing that got us to Trump. This is just using Trump as an excuse to try to wrest more power away from moderates or so-called elites and get it into the hands of Tea Party-style conservatives.
Right, and that's why it's likely to fail. But it does highlight that, look, next week we are going to have a series of debates about the party, the future of the party, and there is going to be some tension that's going to play out in this week leading up to the Republican National Convention.
Right. And so you've written about sort of the constitution, small c, of this national convention. And it seems as though, I just read a few hours ago that Tom Brady isn't speaking or isn't endorsing Trump after all, but it seems as though they've been looking around. I mean, they got in so much trouble 4 years ago when Clint Eastwood talked to that empty chair. You'd think that in some ways they'd be thinking, well, maybe just have experienced political people giving pretty conventional, in both senses of the word, political speeches. But in fact, I mean, well, you've written about the sheer dearth of familiar faces, or even not so familiar faces, who are like governors and members of Congress.
Yeah, so one of the most interesting things that's going to happen this week is Trump's going to roll out his list of speakers at the convention. And, you know, a lot of people have said that they don't want to speak. Some people will. And you know, Scott Walker has come out, said he's going to speak at the convention. A speaking slot at the Republican National Convention used to be, for many years been this very coveted thing. It got you, it got you a lot of FaceTime. It got your name out in bright lights, a lot of attention, and it was something that people wanted. Now, in the year of Donald Trump, it's something that people don't necessarily want as much. A lot of people are saying they don't want it. Now, it should be noted that there are some people who are probably going to accept speaking slots. They're going to say, look, I'm willing to go out there and take the risk of being tied to Donald Trump, because the bottom line is the speaking spot at the RNC is still something that is still something to be wanted. It's something to be had. It's something that gets you a lot of attention. So Scott Walker is one of those people who's going to come out and he's going to speak at the convention he announced today. And you're probably going to see some others, but you're also going to see a lot of people who are not going to have anything to do with this convention.
Right. And I would also guess there's going to be a lot of push and pull from the Trump people about this. If, in fact, your goal as a speaker is to kind of get some meta message out that somehow or other beyond Trump or detaches the Republican movement as a whole from the specifics of Trump for the purposes of furthering down ticket races or furthering your own credibility as a sane human being in a chaotic political world. If that's your plan getting out there, I would imagine the Trump watchdogs would be pretty vigilant about that. There's a limit to how much you can cut some of the ties to us.
Right, and there's going to be a lot of attention paid to what do people actually say in their speeches. Do you spend your time talking about yourself, or do you spend your time talking about Donald Trump? Well, you take a look at Scott Walker. He hasn't had a lot of great things to say about Donald Trump generally. So it's going to be interesting to see, you know, what does he end up saying, and does that end up causing some tension with Donald Trump's team?
One of the things that you mentioned in the previous segment, Alex Eisenstadt, is the notion that one of the other stories that we're about to run into is the Trump Veep watch. Now, the conventional wisdom is always that, you know, there's a limited upside to any vice presidential pick. You know, the worst you can do or the best you can do is not hurt yourself. That McCain is an example of somebody who really hurt himself with just a bad piece of judgment. But by and large, you don't get that much of a bump. You can damage yourself a little bit. Nothing about the Trump candidacy is normal. Nothing about it follows the conventional rules. And I think everybody is looking at this wondering, well, he will send us some kind of signal about what kind of campaign he's running, depending on who he picks. So there was some back and forth, some bantering at the Aspen Institute over the weekend between Biden and Newt Gingrich that kind of left me reading it thinking, wow, Gingrich isn't out of consideration for this. Are there any current whispers or rumors about who's in, who's out?
Well, look, I mean, you look at the names who are supposedly in. Joni Ernst, the Iowa senator, met with Trump over the weekend. Chris Christie is supposedly in, not a huge surprise. He's been close to Trump now for a while. Newt Gingrich is supposedly getting a look. Mary Fallon, the governor of Oklahoma. Mike Pence, the governor of Indiana. All these people share one thing in common, though, which is that they are open to Trump and they are willing to serve as his vice president. And a lot of people in the party simply aren't.
So, yeah, I mean, I just thought it was sort of interesting that Gingrich – I mean, one of the things that Trump has said, and Gingrich pointed it out at Aspen, was that he will need somebody who really understands Washington, because he, Trump, doesn't understand Washington. Now, Joni Ernst, who's a senator, but she's a pretty famously the pig castration senator, which would probably appeal to Trump. It kind of, you know, fits into the overall tenor and theme and earthiness of his campaign. But I don't think she's maybe the kind of smooth operator that if Trump really wants somebody to be kind of his Dick Cheney, at least at the level of kind of knowing how things work and who to pick up the phone and call and who gets this thing done and stuff like that. I don't think that's Joni Ernst, but it might be Newt Gingrich.
Right, or Chris Christie, for that matter, which is why those two names are sort of at the top of everyone's list. You know, Trump has been kind of honest in this, and he said that he needs someone who has some D.C. experience, someone who understands the way Congress works, who understands the ins and outs of government, which is something that he doesn't really have. And so if you need that, if that's what you're looking for, maybe a Newt Gingrich is the way to go.
All right. Listen, Alex, it's been so great to talk to you. We hope you will come back. Great to have your knowledgeable touch here on this political campaign. Alex Eisenstadt writes about politics for Politico. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
All right. We're going to take a quick break. We're going to come back with Willow Ramos to tell us all about self-driving cars. All right. Well, we've come to the part where Kion Wolf usually gives everybody credit for doing things. And, of course, there's no Kion Wolf. I should have figured this out. So Jonathan McNichol's on the board, where Kion usually is. Greg Hill, as usual, is tweeting for us at WNPR. Colin, you can tweet back at him, or you can start a conversation with Greg at WNPR. Colin, this show was produced by Betsy Kaplan. I can't see who's on the phones over Betsy's head. It's Adriana Smith and Olivia Piper are our interns today. Thank you so much for that. And the part of Bill Curry was played by Tom Brady. And tomorrow we're going to build on the conversation we just had. We're doing a show about kind of plumbing the question: do we have too much democracy or not enough? You could sort of look at the way that people feel that their votes don't count as much as they would like them to, and think that there are ways in which there are incursions on our democracy, or maybe even attempts to keep people from voting when they have a right. But you could also make the case, you know, when you have a wide open process, it can lead to, I don't know, the nomination of a real demagogue, or, you know, I mean, in a different country, it can cause you to leave the European Union. So too much democracy, not enough democracy. We'll talk about that tomorrow. Right now, we're going to talk to Willow Ramos. He is a technology writer for Slate, and he's one of the guys we really depend on to help us understand technology that we don't understand. He's been looking into, in particular, a car crash, a terrible car crash, in which a 40-year-old former Navy SEAL was killed when his Tesla Model S crashed into the side of a truck while, at least allegedly, driving itself. Will, welcome to this conversation.
Thanks for having me.
So it seems as though, you know, there's that term mesofacts, the sort of the thing you learn and then things change and you don't necessarily change your own understanding of it. So the mesofact in my head is one of these days we're going to get driverless cars. But as this terrible accident that you wrote about points out, no, we already have driverless cars. There's no particular reason to suppose when you're on the road that there's a driverless car near you, but there's also no particular guarantee that there isn't.
Right. You know, the new technology always brings with it some difficulties in semantics. And one of those has to do with the word driverless or self-driving, or in the case of the Tesla that was involved in a fatal crash, the term is autopilot. So you used the term driverless just now. It's an interesting term. It's reminiscent of horseless carriages a little bit, which was obviously, you know, one of the early names for what became the automobile. A driverless car, to me, if it were up to me to define that term, which it isn't, that would be a car that doesn't require a human driver to be involved at all.
Right.
That is, there's actually a classification system that was drawn up by NHTSA, the National Highway Transportation Safety Administration, and it divides levels of automation from 1 to 5. So level 5 automation would be fully driverless. It's a car that can get from point A to point B without any human intervention. It might not even have a brake or a steering wheel, as Google has shown us with some of its prototypes for driverless cars. In between, in between level 1, which might be something like cruise control, and level 5, are several other levels of automation. So it's on a spectrum here. And the Tesla that crashed was had a mode called autopilot, which NHTSA would classify as level 2 automation. Basically, this car can it can accelerate, it can brake, it can steer under certain driving conditions, but a driver is expected to be behind the wheel at all times, ready to take over at a moment's notice should something go wrong. So it's not driverless in that sense. There has to be a driver there. And in fact, by law, you can't yet have a car on the highway that doesn't have a driver ready to take over at any time.
Right. No, driverless is clearly a misnomer for all of that. So there's always a contrast, too, between what a product tells you about itself and what people's actual expectations of that product are, or a difference between how a product tells you how to use it and how people actually do use it. So, you know, you can say Tesla or any of the 19 companies that are at some stages right now of self-driving or autopilot-y kinds of cars can say, well, we really do expect you to keep one hand on the wheel at all time and, you know, not to engage in distracted driving and pay attention and all this kind of stuff. But then there's what the person using the product thinks about the product. And that seems to have maybe been the case with Joshua Brown, that he had a little bit more faith in the autopilot aspect of his Tesla than maybe even Tesla would have suggested he have.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. So Tesla will tell you, if you have a car with autopilot mode, it will tell you that the purpose of this mode is a safety feature. You know, it's there to help you out. It's there, you know, in case you, you know, Elon Musk has pointed out that if someone were to fall asleep at the wheel, the driverless mode could take over and maybe save them from a gruesome accident. You are expected to still be paying full attention at all times. Now, get behind the wheel of a car with autopilot, and what are you going to do? I mean, are you going to just keep driving as normal, or are you going to try out this exciting new technology by taking your hands off the wheel and seeing what it can do? And if you get used to using it on a regular basis to take over when you're on the highway, maybe you start to tune out even a little more than we already do when we're behind the wheel of a car that you have to drive.
Right. So I think it was 2013, Google sort of they got interested. What's the human factor here? What do people do when you tell them that the car is essentially robotic in nature? So they studied that, right? They put people on the road with cameras in the cars, and they found all kinds of distracted behaviors up to and including what you mentioned, falling asleep. People would just fall asleep in a car that they presumably wouldn't have fallen asleep in if they thought they were, you know, the primary driver of that car. That when you tell people that the car is driving itself, no matter what else you tell them, a certain percentage of people are going to take a lot of liberties with that.
That's right. And I should note, there are some features in place in Tesla cars with autopilot that are meant to keep you from just completely abdicating your responsibility as a driver. If you have your hands off the wheel and its sensors notice that and notice that they're not 100% confident in where you're going next or what needs to happen, or they can't tell whether the thing in front of you is a car or a sign or that sort of thing, it will beep and tell you to put your hands back on the wheel. And at some point, if you're not driving at all, it will actually, after it's warned you several times, it'll actually slow down and you know, come to a stop to avoid driving on its own. Now, that said, ever since Tesla's autopilot mode was released last year, people have been posting videos on YouTube of themselves driving hands-free. In fact, Joshua Brown himself, the man who was involved in this fatal accident, the man who was killed in the crash, had posted YouTube videos that had gotten a lot of views showing off the Tesla autopilot mode's defensive driving ability. So he had one where his hands were off the wheel, a big truck started to come into his lane, and the car sort of slowed down and steered out of the way on its own. He was obviously very proud of that. It seemed like maybe he got a little too comfortable because there's now evidence to suggest that, in fact, when he was involved in that fatal accident, he was maybe watching a movie on a portable DVD player in his car.
Right. So it's by the way, the automotive engineering term for this phenomenon is called overtrust, which I think pretty well sums it up.
That's a good term.
Yeah. So, overtrust. So, so to the point of that video, I mean, these kinds of accounts are not absolutely 100% reliable. What we have is the account of the truck driver whose truck was involved in the collision. And this collision was horrible. It seems to have, I guess, kind of almost ripped the Tesla car, the top right off of it, and ripped poor Joshua Brown pretty badly as well. But as the interior of the car was coming exposed and the sound from it was therefore more audible, the truck driver said that he was pretty sure that he heard a Harry Potter movie. And although I guess you wrote that this is not possible to do using like the dashboard features of the Tesla, it did appear as though there was, at least there are reports that there was a DVD player in the car.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, and we may never know for sure exactly how much attention Joshua Brown was paying to the road. What we do know that's interesting from the perspective of your mesofact, as you put it, which is the bigger question of whether self-driving cars are the future. What we do know is that not only did the driver, Joshua Brown, fail to notice the big rig truck making a turn across traffic in front of him, but Tesla's autopilot system failed to notice it, and it was because it failed to differentiate between the truck, which is apparently a white truck in a brightly lit sky, so it's probably a very reflective surface. That's always been a problem for computer vision, which is the field of computer science and AI that involves teaching computers to see like humans do. And so it mistakenly thought that maybe there was a sign overhead or something, because the truck's body was well off the ground. It wasn't low to the ground like a car would be. So it was confused. It did not recognize it as a truck. It drove on through thinking that the car could drive right under it. That's obviously a grievous mistake for the autopilot system to make. And it's the exact kind of mistake that we sort of would have all hoped had been worked out before we start trusting our lives with these systems. And that's exactly why you're supposed to be paying full attention at all times, because, you know, as good as they are and as far as they have come in a few years' time, self-driving car systems are not yet perfect. And in fact, Tesla's is significantly less sophisticated than the ones that Google has pioneered, which are in fact meant to be able to function without human intervention.
So then the question becomes, how safe does a self-driving or autopilot or robotic car have to be in order to be safe enough? I think it was in your article that you said that the Tesla car had actually, in terms of the number of miles traveled in aggregate by drivers without an accident, before this accident, far exceeded or at least substantially exceeded what regular drivered cars do. But the question would be, and you know, do these kinds of cars have to do better than that? And I guess the National Highway and Transportation Safety Association says yes. Administration says yes. They do. They have to be safer than, you know, than my Subaru Forester is.
Yeah, in fact, the administrator of NHTSA has said, I don't know if this was off the cuff, I don't think it was a matter of policy, but he said he would like to see them be at least twice as safe as human drivers before we start trusting them. It was actually Tesla and Elon Musk in their blog post about the crash where they pointed out that Teslas have driven so far about 130 million miles on autopilot. This is the first fatality that has occurred while it was on autopilot. And on average, there is a vehicle fatality on U.S. roads about every 90 to 100 million miles driven. So by that statistic alone, autopilot seems to be potentially safer. I think it's way too early to say. I mean, what if there's another fatality involving autopilot tomorrow? Is it all of a sudden definitively less safe? I don't think so. I think we need a larger sample size to determine exactly how safe this is. But I think everybody would agree. I think Tesla would agree. Google would agree that in order for self-driving cars to become our future, they need to be significantly safer than the baseline that we have today. I mean, everyone agrees that the number of vehicle fatalities on U.S. roads is awful. It's horrific. And if automating vehicles is only going to match that terrible baseline, I don't think that's something people are going to go for.
It also raises some questions about a term that gets used a lot in the industries that you cover, Will Oremus, and that is the term beta, all right? These things are often referred to as beta models. They are effectively test models, and no less an expert in that term than Steve Wozniak has said. I mean, he owns one of these Teslas, but he says, you know, a beta feature, a beta model of something shouldn't kill you. In other words, that shouldn't be the standard, that if something goes wrong, you lose your life, that there's something wrong with putting something out there as a beta, that if in fact it doesn't work quite the way that it's supposed to work, which is kind of built into the assumption a little bit with beta testing,
yeah,
that the
right.
consequences
yeah,
so, would be so high.
Yeah, Tesla. So Tesla, before you can enable autopilot on your car, it makes you acknowledge that this is, it's a new technology and it's in a public beta phase, so that you are agreeing to that when you use it. Now, it's one thing to put a new version of Gmail in a public beta phase. I think some people might see it differently when it comes to cars. Exactly as you said, I think a lot of you'll see the major automakers are moving much more slowly when it comes to self-driving technology. You could say that's because they they don't have the daring, can-do Silicon Valley spirit. They're conservative or stuck in their ways, and so they've been slow to adopt the hot new thing. I think they would say, I think they certainly have the resources. They probably could have implemented something like autopilot by now if they wanted to, but they are protective of their reputations. They have understood, they've been in this business a long time, they've understood how crucial safety is to their business, and so they have moved more slowly, whereas Tesla has embodied that sort of Silicon Valley mentality of let's get it out there. Facebook's unofficial motto used to be move fast and break things. That's one thing when it's a social network, maybe a little less palatable when the things that you're breaking are cars and people.
Yeah, but Will, I also feel as though the message out of the auto industry is, and I hesitate to use the word insidious, but at least sort of there's this latent message that we're getting in advertising that sort of backs up the notion that we should trust technology more and more. So I was watching something last night and I saw a commercial, I think, for a Mazda, and it shows this couple with their brand new baby, and they're just leaving the hospital with a brand new baby, and they get the baby back in the car seat, and the guy starts backing up, and there's a car coming, and the Mazda tells him that it's coming, and then he gets out on the highway, and there's a truck pulling up on the left side view mirror, and the Mazda tells him, and the entire message of this commercial is, like, I'm not even quite sure what I'm supposed to think. Like, this baby would be dead now if the Mazda hadn't told them this stuff? Or you can think about other things on your ride home from the hospital with your new baby, because this Mazda, it's not robotic, it's not autopilot, it's not self-driving, it's just the way cars are equipped now with sensors that beep at you to tell you of oncoming hazards. But it seems to me the subliminal message of that commercial is, trust us more and more, we're going to keep you safe.
Yeah, I mean, clearly tech companies would love you to trust them more and more. And the trick is distinguishing which technology is worthy of your trust and which isn't. With the Tesla autopilot technology, I think it's an open question. It's clearly impressive. Clearly, the technology has come a very long way. I mean, it was only a little over a decade ago, I think, that there was the first DARPA Grand Challenge for self-driving cars, for autonomous vehicles, which at the time was something nobody had ever heard of, or people didn't even imagine this was possible. And in fact, when the leading computer scientists in the world got together and tried to do it, it failed miserably. I mean, the best car drove a very short distance and crashed into a rock or something. All the others had already crashed before then. We've come an amazing distance. The technology is improving rapidly. I have no doubt the technology will continue to improve. And I think, if it does succeed in gaining the public's trust, maybe eventually we will get to a safer world where cars either drive us entirely on their own via software, or where they have what you're talking about with those Mazda commercials, which is something Toyota has been working on, which is maybe we are still the driver, but maybe the technology is there as a backstop. Maybe it intervenes when we do something wrong. Now, that's actually the inverse of what the Tesla autopilot system does. So with the Tesla system, autopilot is saying, look, we'll do the easy stuff. We'll take over on sort of cruise control on the highway when everything's clearly lit and well marked. You just need to be there to step in for the hard stuff. Maybe that's not the ideal strategy. I mean, if you're not doing the easy stuff, are you really ready to step in for the hard stuff? So another approach is this idea of, maybe the human still has to do all the easy stuff. We don't get any of the convenience benefits, but the computer is there to help with the hard stuff. Something comes out of nowhere, our reaction time might be slower than that of the software. Maybe it can save us.
Last quick question, Will Arimus. You said before, what if there's another accident tomorrow? Well, one question that I think all of us have who followed the story is, well, if there's an accident tomorrow, how long will it take before we find out about it? This terrible accident involving Joshua Brown happened in early May, in an era where, if Don King changes his hair products, you find out about it on Twitter 60 seconds later. So it's rather unusual that something like this sits below the radar. any ideas about why it took so long to find out about this?
Well, you know, I don't think we know yet how much to blame Tesla, if at all, for that delay. So all indications are, so the crash happened on a Florida highway on May 7th. All indications are that Tesla immediately reported it to NHTSA, the National Highway Transportation Safety Administration. I'm getting really good at saying that.
Yeah, you are.
By the way. They reported it immediately, but then NHTSA, it seems, sat on it and didn't release the information for quite a while. So it wasn't necessarily Tesla that was keeping it from the public. Maybe they were waiting for NHTSA to weigh in. On the other hand, I'm sure Tesla wanted to do its own investigation before they disclosed this publicly. So it was certainly in their interest to have all their defenses ready and all their...
Willow Remus, I'm going to have to interrupt you. We are flat out of time right now. You are, as usual, so informative about this. Thanks for joining us today. Thanks to everybody who helped out. We will talk to you tomorrow. Listen to the diatone.